listen to the best of the church's music for the season of Lent at LutheranPublicRadio.org. Sacred music for the season of Lent, LutheranPublicRadio.org.
Welcome back to Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Sometimes difficult to understand the motivations of terrorist groups like ISIS, like the Islamic State, especially when they seem to have a similar animus directed toward the West, toward Christians, toward other religious minorities, and even toward fellow Muslims, even something a group called Sufi Muslims. We're going to talk about who they are and why ISIS from time to time targets them as well. Joining us to do so on this Tuesday afternoon, February the 28th, Robert Spencer. He's a regular guest, director of Jihad Watch, author of several books on Islam, including The Complete Infidel's Guide to ISIS and his latest publication, The Complete Infidel's Guide to Iran. Robert, welcome back to Issues, Etc.
A pleasure, Todd. How are you?
I'm doing well. Give us some recent examples of ISIS targeting Sufis.
It actually just happened in the middle of February, just a couple weeks ago, that a jihad martyrdom suicide bomber killed at least 72 people, injuring many, many more, in southern Pakistan at a Sufi shrine, the shrine of Lal Shahbaz Qalandar, who was a saint of the Sufis. And this was after just 3 months before that, in November 2016, there was another attack on a Sufi shrine north of Karachi, also in Pakistan. The Islamic State claimed credit for both, ISIS, and they have been targeting Sufis all over, wherever they can get to them, within their domains or in places where they have influence. They are trying to kill as many Sufis as possible.
Who are the Sufis, and why does ISIS have such animus toward them?
The Sufis are a mystical sect of Islam. Sect is really not really the word, not precisely the correct word, because it's not as if you are a Sunni or a Shiite or a Sufi. There are Sunni Sufis, and Ayatollah Khomeini, the Shiite leader of the Islamic Republic of Iran, was very much influenced by the Sufis. It's more of a way of looking at Islam that is much more mystical and much more directed toward love of God and toward union with God, toward a real experience of God, than other kinds of Islam, other ways of living out Islam. And so often they are targeted by, particularly by more orthodox Sunni Muslims, for being heretical in the sense that they are supposed to be misunderstanding or misinterpreting various aspects of Islam, particularly in regard to the fact that they are generally, although not universally, nonviolent.
All right. What is it about their practices, their beliefs in particular, I imagine it has a lot to do with their devotion to certain places and shrines, that ISIS finds so difficult?
Yeah. You see, Muhammad, the prophet of Islam, in a hadith, the tradition that reports about his words and deeds, or what he's supposed to have said and done, he says that don't imitate the Jews and Christians who have actually incurred the curse of Allah by praying at the shrines of their saints. And so the Sufis, because they do have shrines, just like this one that a couple weeks ago was bombed in Pakistan, they are considered to be transgressing the direct express command of Muhammad. And that makes them heretics, and heretics in Islam are under a death sentence, so they are targeted for this.
Now, this kind of highlights the fact that there are various sects of Islam where there's historic violence, even apart from the history of the Islamic State. How would you describe the animosity, the Muslim-on-Muslim animosity that has existed for centuries?
Well, you know, where in whatever context you find it, Todd, it all comes down to that death penalty for heresy. A murtad, a heretic, is somebody who is considered to have forfeited his right to live. And it's the responsibility of a Muslim, even without a command, even without express permission from the leader, to kill him. And so this has fueled Sunni-Shiite animosity, Shiite-Sunni animosity, the animosity of both towards Sufis, and much more.
So within the various sects of Islam, the Sufis kind of cross those lines. Did I hear you say that before?
Yes, that's right. And you know, it's very interesting to note also that the Sufi influence shows up in all sorts of improbable contexts, that even while they are being persecuted by other Muslims as being heretical, the founder of the Muslim Brotherhood, Hassan al-Banna, was actually quite taken with the Sufi tradition, and he prescribed Sufi spiritual exercises for the early Muslim Brotherhood members in Egypt in the late 1920s. So this is not something that he considered to be incompatible with his vision of restoring the purity of Islam, restoring the caliphate, reasserting the principles of political Islam, and so on.
Would you say that, just looking in from the outside, that the Sufi influence in Islam, and you had mentioned that they are largely nonviolent, is it a beneficial influence in Islam?
Well, certainly in the sense that it does, or can, I should say, doesn't always, but it can mitigate the tendency to take the martial commands of the Quran literally, then in that sense it's very much a beneficial influence, and that has happened. But at the same time, Sufis were historically, up until the Saudi Wahhabis moved in the 20th century, from the 18th century on to the mid-20th century, the Sufis were the leaders of the jihad in Chechnya against the Russians. And they never considered that there was any incompatibility between their fighting that jihad, the hot war, that is, and their Sufi identity. So it's not as if they are universally nonviolent, but at the same time, because they do have a tendency that is not found in other traditions of Islam to spiritualize the Quran and to read it as if it were all instructions for the soul and for the inner life rather than for outward behavior, that can tend to mitigate and has tended to mitigate the martial aspects of the Quran's message.
Which branch of Islam is predominant in ISIS and its leaders?
Well, ISIS is just standard Orthodox Sunni Islam. Now, a lot of people would say, oh, no, it's hijacked. That's not not really Islam at all. But in reality, ISIS very scrupulously follows the Sunni tradition as delineated by Muhammad ibn Abdul Wahhab, the Wahhabi leader, who was actually a Muslim reformer in Arabia in the 18th century, who swept away what he considered to be later accretions and additions to the message and got back to the basics. And out of that Wahhabi tradition comes Al-Qaeda, and then from Al-Qaeda comes ISIS. So it's all really, it's sort of a very strict and by-the-book, literalistic understanding of the Quran and Muhammad's message.
So Wahhabism is not in itself a theological distinction within Islam, but it is a, how should we put it, it is an attitude that is adopted, whatever your position may be, that strict adherence.
Yeah, exactly. It's a reform movement. People talk about wanting Islamic reform, and I think be careful what you wish for. You might get it, because Wahhab was a reformer. He wanted to sweep away what were later additions in Islam and get back to the basics of the message. And that's what Wahhabism is. And because of the nature of the message, it is a more virulent and violent form of Islam than had been expressed by other traditions. It is the official religion of Saudi Arabia, and of course the Saudis have spent hundreds of billions of dollars, probably trillions by now, to spread it around the world. So you have places like Chechnya, where there was a form of Islam that was really quite different from Wahhabism, that was entirely supplanted by Wahhabism in the late 20th century. And this was able to happen. This could only be made possible by the fact that the Wahhabis are so by the book. So when they were challenged, they were able to say, look, the Quran says this, Muhammad says this, so this is what we have to do. And so they were able to overwhelm other understandings of Islam by going chapter and verse, pointing to the book, showing Muslims that this they were doing exactly what the book said.
Why is it, Robert, that the Wahhabism of ISIS is considered to be threatening, but the Wahhabism that is found in the Saudi family is for some reason ignored?
Oh, Todd, that's such a big question. That's a very important question, and it shows up the absurdity and the wrongheadedness of American foreign policy. Both parties, obviously our alliance, so-called, with the Saudis is based on the need for Saudi oil and is a marriage of convenience. And so we excuse the Saudis doing what we excoriate ISIS for doing when both are working from the same theological assumptions within Islam. This is something that I hope is going to get sorted out if the swamp in Washington is indeed drained in the coming years.
Is it largely recognized by the State Department that there is an affinity of beliefs and of practices between the Saudi families and ISIS, or is that just simply denied?
It's neither denied nor affirmed. It's just completely ignored. To my knowledge, the State Department has never issued any kind of public acknowledgement of the fact that it's fighting ISIS while ISIS is doing essentially the same things that its ally Saudi Arabia is doing.
Robert Spencer is director of Jihad Watch and author of several books on Islam, including The Complete Infidel's Guide to ISIS and his latest publication, The Complete Infidel's Guide to Iran. You'll find these books and a link to Jihad Watch at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. Robert, thanks for your time.
Pleasure, Todd. Thank you.
We're going to be talking with Dr. Alvin Schmidt on the other side of the break, part two of a series we're doing with him on Lutheran identity. One of the issues that came up during the time of the Reformation that's often not really recognized or rightly understood, in fact, it's often deeply misunderstood, is the issue of New Testament canonicity. What books belong in the New Testament? Luther's position might surprise you. We'll talk about it with Dr. Alvin Schmidt after this.
I'm not a Christian, but I listen to your show because actually you do have some interesting topics.
Here's a recent comment from the Issues Etc. comment line.
You believe that there's not one error in the Bible. That's intellectually infantile. You also believe that Jesus is coming again. You promote extremely sexually repressive views.
The Issues Etc. comment line. Available 24/7. 618-223-8382.
Have fun waiting for Jesus to return. Got news for you. He ain't coming back.
Have you been too busy to get your associate's, bachelor's, or master's degree? Concordia University, Wisconsin offers 50 online educational options. Find out more at issuesetc.org. Click the Concordia University online logo and enter the program code ISSUES to waive your application fee. Concordia University, Wisconsin is here to strengthen and support the church. Lifelong Lutheran learning. issuesetc.org and click Concordia University, Wisconsin online.
Your comprehensive source for information, teaching, and truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
The 500th anniversary of the Reformation approaches. A good time to ask, who are we as Confessional Lutherans? What's our heritage? The Confessional Lutherans for Christ Commission has produced the Layman's Guide to Theological History. Go to the clcc.org and see which of these presentations and books would be most helpful to you and your fellow parishioners. And consider becoming a member with us as the CLCC seeks to help more people know what it means to be a confessional Lutheran. The clcc.org.
Come listen to Drs. Alvin Schmidt and Roland Elke at the 3rd Annual Concordia Apologetics Conference, Cultures in Collision, Faith and a Fractured World, this March 3rd and 4th at Concordia University, Wisconsin. You can register online at www.cuw.edu/apologetics or call 262-243-4343. That's the Concordia Apologetics Conference, March 3rd and 4th at Concordia University, Wisconsin.